Right, here we are. Welcome back to Book Wave, the book club podcast. Today we're looking at Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm Scott, joined by Pat.
Hey.
Will.
Hello.
And Synapsian.
Yo, yo, yo.
And if you're new around here, you can check us out at our website, bookwave.club. And my first question to you guys regarding Friedrich Nietzsche, since I feel so underqualified to really go into this, my first question is, who would you pick to interview Friedrich Nietzsche, and why? And why do you think it would be beneficial? Let's start with you, Will.
Okay. So you just sprung this question on me, and I had no time to prepare. And a whole bunch of names are going through my head. At first, I was like, maybe Sigmund Freud, maybe Albert Einstein, maybe Gandhi, maybe definitely not Jordan Peterson, because that would just be 1,000 hours and I'd get nothing out of it.
That might be a little bit too deep.
I think my gut is telling me Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, like post-emancipation, pre-headshot. I think that man would be able to have an interesting dialogue with Nietzsche, because he seems like a guy who would be able to have a conversation that was grounded and not lofty. And Nietzsche, obviously, is very lofty. Like, he literally thinks his thoughts are birds. So, yeah, I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln.
All right. I'll just, one of the thoughts that I had was Ayn Rand, because there's a lot of points when reading this book where I'm like, this sounds a little bit like Ayn Rand wasn't influenced solely by Aristotle. I think she must have read some Nietzsche too, because there's some pretty heavy consistencies, but then again, I haven't read Aristotle, so maybe my answer is Aristotle. With some kind of Doctor Who English translation machine.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that, Scott. What do you think, Pat?
I honestly don't know, but I mean, are we talking about in the timeline that he was still alive, or could it just be anyone?
Literally anybody.
I mean, if your person is talking to Nietzsche in his tomb and Nietzsche's not responding, that will be a boring conversation.
Well, we'll have to pick him out like Nietzsche previous to his mental breakdown. And, you know, you picked a specific timeline for Abraham Lincoln. So,
yeah,
you know, be creative with it.
I don't know. I think I would have to go with any political philosopher living today. Doesn't matter which one,
just to try to get like a modern take on it.
Yeah, just to get a modern take on it and what he thinks about it. I think that would be more engaging instead of just having past philosophers or even presidents even talk to him. I would say, just to point out I like to hear from his own work transcribed to a modern philosopher, and just slowly and instinctually dissect that person's philosophy altogether, just to see what the response might be.
That could be interesting. I'll defend my president after Synapsian shares his bit.
Yeah.
Well, it sounded like you guys picked politicians or Stoics, and I would differ and pick like one of the great meditators of time, like maybe Thich Nhat Hanh or Ajahn Amaro, contemporary monk, Buddhist monk. And I say that because I think it'd be interesting having a Buddhist monk's perspective contrasting with Nietzsche's the nihilistic aspects of Nietzsche, so that, you know, I think that could be a meaningful conversation. I would definitely not pick Jordan Peterson, since he did a full 45 minutes on two sentences of Nietzsche's You're right, Will. That would take forever.
It would
See,
never
I'd
end.
pick a meditator.
That's
And
interesting.
also, I don't think that during Nietzsche's time, especially when he wrote this book, that he was very influenced by the Eastern traditions. So it'd be interesting to see how that relationship panned out.
That's interesting because when I've read the first part where he talks about the prejudices of other philosophers, I sort of had this idea of him being the outsider of these group of philosophers throughout time. He was essentially looking for his own and saying, "No, fuck you. I'm not going to be a part of your group.
There's
I'm going to
no other
make
way
my
to
own."
word that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry,
He was
YouTube.
he was essentially saying F you to all the other people in a group. And he's like, I'm going to make my own. I'm going to make a ton of enemies for sure. And I'm going to present my own ideas and thoughts, which is kind of ironic because he also talks about where all these morals come from, essentially, especially when it comes to Christianity, and the nature of Christianity's history.
So I just want to dwell on that first question just for like maybe 2 more minutes, because the reason I want the Abraham Lincoln Nietzsche discussion is largely based on the latter few chapters where he talks about this whole master-slave mentality. And it's selfish of me as well to ask for Abraham Lincoln, because again, we don't really know what kind of a man Abraham Lincoln is beyond our history of him. And so it would be very interesting to see the man who, from what I understand, did quite a lot of good work in freeing the slaves, talk to a man who believes in a mentality of masters and a mentality of slaves, and to find out if Abraham Lincoln agrees with that or disagrees with that. Because you can agree with that and abolish slavery, and you can disagree with that and abolish slavery. And I think that that would be a very interesting conversation. But I also think I have an adversity to present day philosophers, because I fear that they'd be the kind of people that Nietzsche would just curse out, like, and curse out in the way that he dissects Descartes' I think, therefore I am. And I fear that present day philosophers are falling victim to the same folly of the philosophers he was eviscerating in the first couple chapters, is that they're taking things for granted and then building their philosophy upon those things that they should not have taken for granted.
Yeah, and especially when they don't even know about themselves. They're just projecting outward.
I fear, but again, I haven't spent much time in universities. I don't know what the philosophers of universities are like, but from what I get from the trickle down of media is that there's just less focus on truth and more focus on emotion these days.
Yeah, facts don't care about your feelings, folks. I'd like to see someone like be as ruthless with Nietzsche as Nietzsche is with some of the other philosophers that he mentions. Like he even like Synapsian mentioned the Stoics. He tore a new one into the Stoics. It's like how can you even begin with you live according to nature when nature is just living according to life? To say that you're living according to life says nothing at all. So I have nothing else to say to you, Stoics.
I think those, man, there's something to be said about reading someone disagreeing with someone else, especially after like we opened up for me when I got into the podcast with meditations, like with Stoic philosophy, and we've seen in popular culture the rise of the Stoics, and it's turned into a commodity. Like there is Stoic wisdom. There's 1,000 Instagram channels posting Stoic quotes or making up quotes about people that they think are Stoic. And to have this guy say, "You're all idiots and your entire philosophy is BS," it was like, "Oh crap, I was in this comfortable space where I thought stoicism was cool, and then I had someone share insight, and now it's like, oh, right.
Ryan Holiday might be another good one to interview Nietzsche, just to get a defense of stoicism, maybe, because Ryan Holiday uses as a prime example of stoicism a phrase that Nietzsche popularized, amor fati, which is basically just when Jocko says good, something terrible happens in your life, just amor fati, love of fate, good.
Right.
And like, yep. If that's not stoic, I don't know what is. So I'd like to see how much ground Nietzsche would yield in a conversation with a stoic when they really got into what it means to be a stoicism instead of the semantic meaning of a stoic.
True. Yeah.
Will, to pick up on something you were talking about, the slavery and master that he described in the latter part of the book, was he literally talking about the people, slave and master, or was he talking more metaphorically of like a slave to an idea of oneself?
Well, he basically said that everybody either falls into a slave morality or a master morality. And like half of the book, he talks about Christianity being a slave morality and comparing it to just absolute slavery to this other person's ideal, and how other people who make their own ideals and their own morals, they're considered to be like members of the master morality and on their way to becoming an Übermensch, which is translated as Superman or Overman. I like to just call it Übermensch to get rid of confusion.
Yeah, it's the idea of taking advantage of the genius,
mm-hmm.
which is really rare to do.
And he talks a lot about, as well, societies being built to prop up the evolution of these Übermensch, right? And the notion, like, I think he used a metaphor of this vine encircling a large oak tree to prop itself up and get to the height that it would be able to spread its leaves. And I think he talked about it literally and metaphorically, because there was a point as well where he said that, you know, this isn't a mentality that is strict and limited to its own existence. You can have both the master and slave mentality within one man. But then, of course, he goes on to riff about these Übermensch coming across individuals as either beneficial to their cause, detrimental to their cause, a refuge from their cause, or... No, I think that's the three options, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a...
So to answer your question, yes.
There's a lot of similarities between Nietzsche and Dostoevsky in talking about pretty much the same thing. Like in Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov writes the newspaper article or the scientific article about the Superman, how we should all aim to be that greater version of us. And when he talks about it, he refers a lot to Napoleon being the Übermensch. So
yeah. Now, Crime and Punishment came out after or before Beyond Good and Evil, Scott?
I'm not sure. Around the same time, I would think. 1886 is the year Beyond Good and Evil came out. If you want to Google Crime and Punishment real quick.
I think it came out before Beyond Good and Evil, I would say.
It came out in 1866.
Oh, so yeah. About 20 years.
Right. Which is crazy because they're so similar. Like, if you had told me that Beyond Good and Evil came out in 66 and Crime and Punishment in 88, I would have said, oh, okay, totally. That makes sense. Because, like, what Raskolnikov goes through is so very related to this Übermensch concept he talks about. It's almost upsetting that he wrote about it afterwards.
Yeah. You'd have to ask the question how much they influenced each other then. That's a question I'm sure Jordan Peterson would be able to answer if he was here.
Yes, well, he would.
That podcast will be very long.
That would be a live stream. Let's talk about Christians and Nietzsche.
Okay. I now figured out
Do they?
the phrase "God is dead," and that's where Beyond Good and Evil comes. It comes from.
You want to expand on that?
God is dead comes from Thus Spake Zarathustra, and then expanded on in Beyond Good and Evil.
Right. Yeah, he goes on to say that all these demands and self-denial that Christians go through is a way of pushing their dreams onto other people, especially those who don't. It's especially in a modern society where the idea of God is no longer favorable, and that's. I have my notes here, if I can find it. He claims that Christianity forces a man to reject the lifestyle that is leisure and other ideas of like climbing up the hierarchy, so to speak. And in a way, the way that the religion deals with is like going up Jacob's ladder, where you have to make an ultimate sacrifice, sacrificing somebody or an animal for the sake of freedom and strength. And after which comes the paradox, which is he says he mentions the sacrificing of God, because we have all these past ideas about what God is, who God is, where he came from, where did he come from. And the more and more we try to dissect God bit by bit, we essentially sacrifice him until there's nothing left. And how Christianity values our morality is essentially devaluing our instincts. That's where I got the idea from in part three, what is religious?
Right. Yeah, and he talks a lot about that. It's similar in the thread to the way he sort of dissects the Stoicism, is this whole anti-nature existence that clouts being in tune with nature. And I think Christianity does a very good job of making you feel that you shouldn't feel the feelings you feel or the dreams that you dream, and that in order to be a good Christian, you need to be a bad human. And it's odd, and you'll witness it. Just go to the hardware store at noon on a Sunday. You will witness subservience, observance, and some other third thing that is just weird. Like you've got five tills, and there's one line of Christians, and there's no more cashiers, and it's just this one line. And it blew my mind that not a single one of these people, when I got to the back of the line, none of them had said to the five other staff members, work this secondary till and get these people out of the store. And so that's what I said. And when I did say it, all I got was gawking. Like this entire lineup just looked at me like I was Satan incarnate asking for more than what was there for me to receive. And it was just absurd. And I get to the cashier and they're like, yep, it's Sunday.
Yep, a day of rest.
It's just odd. And I think Nietzsche gets so into it and then so beyond it that it's hard to even
Yeah.
cling on to one thing to say, ah, I think this is what Nietzsche's talking about.
Yeah, and I also see him making the point that we kind of broke Christianity by defining God too much. Like it says in lots of points in the Bible and like Islam takes this really seriously, where like the more you try to define what God is, the more you lose what it is that makes it what it is. So like when he said God was dead, it's just like, yeah, well, you did this yourselves. It says right here in your Bible, don't ask questions. You asked your questions, you broke Christianity. Now what are you gonna do? We have to keep asking questions now. You can't just stop. You started this ball rolling. So it's just, where do we go from there?
Yeah.
And I kind of think that there is sort of a bad side too, because nowadays, ever since we've learned more about Jordan Peterson and his biblical lectures, and him essentially saying if you pick out a certain section of the Bible that is good and works in practice, you can take it and discard the rest. And so I'm sure there are people today looking for that kind of thing, especially with atheism running amok all around Western civilization, saying, forget about it. Forget about everything you've learned in church. Everything is meaningless. So have a ball, have a good laugh, and party it up until you die. And somehow, I think that can be a bit daunting and overwhelming because you need to have meaning in your life. You need to pursue something that has a purpose, whatever that might be. And you could say that you can act as if God exists, and you could take that into consideration when you decide to pursue a purpose in life.
And I think one of our big problems is it's not even so much that we've decided to throw God out collectively, it's that we've neglected that. And I think that's probably been 60 years in the working where it isn't even about offering a teenager a choice and saying, hey, do you want to learn about God? It's about throwing them in the education system and saying you need to learn math, history, geography, and civil studies. And while all that's going on, there's going to be even less privileged individuals who have access to narcotics and alcohol, and they're going to tempt you. And we haven't educated you about Satan or temptation or anything, and you're going to fall victim to societal traps and live out a life that, from observation on the outside, you could very easily make the argument that this person is atheistic. But it's not even that, it's that this person isn't even sighted. I can't even describe them as short-sighted because they're not even looking at what they're doing. And they're trying to get to a place that they haven't even questioned where it is. They don't know that they're the lead role in a tragedy of their own life. And they have morality and they know how they want to be treated one-on-one. You know what I mean? When you speak with someone and they know how they want to be spoken to, and they know what they think they need to say, and they know what they think they need to do, but they haven't gotten that from observation or inquiry. They've just gotten it as maybe their role models have inspired this sort of behavior in them, or they saw it on TV for crying out loud. And we have what you could call lots of atheism, but I don't think it's atheism because atheism is a choice and it's an informed decision. And we have uninformed people floating down, face down in the river of life, clinging at roots, and they have no idea what those roots are. It's absurd. And we're moving so fast that I don't know how we're going to get that deep breath to say, oh, I've been living and acting out something that is completely opposite to what I desire for myself.
It's speed.
What do you think, Synapsian?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate where you have people taking that path away from the hyper rationality of religion and assuming that there is, you know, nothing, and they go down a path of nihilism, and maybe they don't realize it until they feel some kind of pain, you know, whether it be physical or psychological pain of their own doing. But ultimately, that's the risk they're running.
Shoot, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry, guys. Someone wanna?
Well, he does have a lot to say about Christianity, but he also has a lot to say about, you know, the different sects within Christianity. Like, he seems to say that, you know, the different forms of Protestantism aren't so bad as Catholicism, but, you know, they're all just kind of a bastardization of the Old Testament, and that mixing the New Testament with the Old Testament was the greatest sin ever committed by mankind. So that was pretty interesting.
And I'd agree with him there. And I think that what's happened in the past 2,000 years is very odd and perverted in terms of interpreting a text and putting a new hat on it and calling it something else. And it's like we've got all of these sects that are actually just the Old Testament propped up by like stilts and surrounded by a trench coat, and there's a rat at the top of it, and he's saying this is actually new. But it's weird, because when you look at, like, the idea is that there was a good reason for this stuff, and that people figured out that these would help you. And then when you look at the other side of the spectrum at 2020, where people don't have that information, like I shared that link to the Dr. K video talking with some guys from the NoFap group, and they're discovering on 7 days clean that they haven't aged emotionally since they were 12, and they are being overtaken by anxiety and depression and dread and confusion and overwhelm, and they relapse. And one of the ones that was actually talking about it, he got involved in the NoFap community because he discovered Christianity. He later discovered atheism, but that's not the point of this discussion. And so he stopped because it's a sin. And what he discovered was, beyond being a sin, it's escapism. And in today's consumer society, with all of the industries and modes of escapism, it's terrifying to consider the notion that there's an entire demographic of 17 to 35-year-olds who've never picked up the Bible, who don't even know what the commandments are, who don't even know what the sins are, who are acting out a life of escapism and immaturity, and have high horsedness.
Yeah, and
a word.
Yeah.
I believe.
And he also goes on, this is the exact same idea when he talks about the natural history of morality, which is, Nietzsche claims that people's perception of what's worth pursuing and what it takes to possess what they are pursuing, and using, you know, any kind of resource available on hand, he suggests that oftentimes we generalize to a collective bias or prior knowledge, that in some ways that we often see it, but we don't often believe it. It's all just in our face, all 360 environments around, and yet we don't even take the time to actually say, is this worth living? Is this my reality? Or is this just a way of, like Will said, a form of escapism over the lively, aggressive, yet more noble way of living?
And we come back to the life unobserved, right? And you know, the question of what is virtuous living and what is good living and what is bad living and what is evil living. And I think that's probably why we opened this book in the first place.
And I think the point is, I think the point is it goes beyond all that, that, you know, good and evil, you can't really define them. Like God, morality, philosophy, theology, it's all in a realm beyond good and evil.
Yeah, and that's the problem when people start to say and observe and label certain things from thousands of miles away and say, this is evil and we need to deal with it, and then get 100,000 people behind them saying, we agree with what this person's saying, we need to change that. And then you have, you know, political bodies like town council invoking their power to this will of a group that, again, doesn't understand what they're saying. They don't know what the end they're looking for is, and they think that their means will get them there, but it's too short-sighted to actually get it, because you can't have just one strict definition of moral laws that will get you out of every single situation in the right way.
Yeah, I almost feel like he's arguing for and against an objective morality at the same time.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, because, like, another problem he has with Christianity is that he forces, or is that Christianity forces the same morality on everybody. And he has this part where he says, like, no, there has to be people with slave morality, and there have to be people with master morality, and you can't just pick who that is. It's gotta, like, come up naturally. That's why he's a fan of the old pagans instead of any of the new monotheistic religions. He worshipped Dionysus.
And it's weird too, because at the time that, you know, he's writing his ideas, we're talking almost 150 years ago, and the developments that we've had in science, technology, industry, insight into the mind and the capabilities of humans, you cannot even take everything he says as truth, because he's so far from the mark of our reality that it'd be impossible for him. Like, it'd be interesting to see him alive today writing this book. Mm-hmm. Because it's constantly mutating what it means to be human, what it means to reach the peak of your performance. And, like, even just in terms of learning sports, 50 years ago, if you were bad at soccer, no one would support you in developing your soccer ability. It was just simply, oh, you're not talented, so then why foster the skill? And nowadays, and as we've seen over the past 50 years, it isn't the people that are naturally talented that excel the furthest, it's the people that work the hardest and actually understand what they're doing and analyze their abilities. But it's crazy, like, to conceive that women and men have their own set of skills and proclivities is bizarre to me in my time period, because I am of the belief that human beings can do what human beings can do, and the notion of gender limits is short-sighted. Like, obviously you don't want women fighting men when we're looking at UFC. You know, if you take the best UFC male and pit him against the best UFC female, it might be really bloody and gross. But I wouldn't say that UFC fighting is the peak of human existence, and I don't think it solves poverty or opportunity lack, or, you know, perpetuate our species into the future. I don't think that helps us get us anywhere. I think sports are a distraction, but I don't think sports are invaluable.
Yeah, and it's essentially a game. It's a game of, you know, who's the best, everybody's looking for the best player out there, and they want to see it in action.
You're going to say something, Synapson?
Yeah, to jump off what Will was saying, to realize the peak of human capabilities, I kind of thought one of the things Nietzsche was doing in this book, where he's differentiating between the good, rational person and the impulsive living being, was pointing out we all live somewhere on a spectrum between there, where you could equate the rational person as being the master minds and the living being with their impulses being of the slave morality. But I think ultimately both of these types of categories you'd find somebody in, they're both the act of self-articulating, what Alan Watts would call selfing. It's individual people identifying with a self and becoming attached to that self, and it leads people to use and think about themselves, think about their lives using first person pronouns quite a bit, like I, me, mine. Whereas if you are selfless, which I think is possibly the height of human capability, to be selfless, where you're not using and you're not attached to those first person pronouns so much. And there's a mental exercise you can do where you just try not to say any of those first person pronouns for a day. Try not to say I or me or mine so much. And I think it leads to a mental place of selflessness. And, you know, if there were a lot less selves and personalities out there all competing, it's possible, you know, we could achieve more as a human society.
I don't know about that. That's where I think Nietzsche and Ayn Rand might have a big problem with what you just said. Because, yeah. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, a lot of people are being too selfish. It's quite another thing to say you should be selfless. Because when you boil it down, it all comes down to the individual. And if nobody is willing to be an individual themselves, then you just have everybody that just lives for the herd. And then it doesn't go anywhere because no one's producing anything. Like
I think that's a short-sighted argument.
Yeah.
I hear you. I agree with your first sentence. I jump off on that last sentence, though, because I think you've got some serious points. But to say, because, yeah, exactly. Like, if everybody was selfless, who would make the selfish call to drive human existence into a particular direction? But the thing is, there's so much that the herd could do for itself that would strengthen the herd.
There's also a lot of selflessness that causes problems. Like, you know, you could think of any situation where just throwing money at the problem out of the goodness of your heart with wanting to help and being completely selfish, just selfless, and just saying, here, take it. It's all going to make you better. And then, you know, that doesn't help them for very long. And they just find themselves in a situation where they just need another handout. You're effectively creating a slave morality that way by giving everyone the instruction to be selfless. I'm not saying you should be 100% selfish, but there has to be a balance in there.
So we talked about this with the wells, right? Where we build a well in Africa and then the well collapses and we build another one 10 meters away from it because we don't want to teach the people who use the well how to maintain the well. And I think that the problem is that you're looking at it as though those that are capable of selflessness and have the tools to be selfless, for those that realistically can't be selfless and aren't in a position to be selfless because they don't have the opportunities and they don't have the education, you're looking at it as them giving them resources and tools, and then them exhausting those resources and breaking those tools and requiring more. And I think I would have fully agreed with you yesterday, but then I had a conversation with someone and they talked about the notion that in order to get to a place where everyone could be able to be selfless, it would start with a great deal of effort and education, and not based on what we perceive education to be. Because for a specific example, we cannot put white education on Native reserves. And I think you'll understand what I mean when I say that, Scott. Because in Canada, that's our problem. We've got some really, really messed up colonial issues in regards to Native reservations. And that's a hydra that we don't need to discuss today. But the notion isn't to fix the problem with white education. The notion is to fix the problem with compassionate, selfless, open-eared discussion to determine what the people need to get out of the spot that they're in. Because if you ask anybody in crisis, if you can disrupt their story and ask them what it is they need to do, or what it is they didn't do, or what it is they did wrong, they know the answer to all of those questions. Anybody on this planet struggling with someone, with something or someone, could tell you what the problem is. But their level of self-deception to avoid dealing with the problem is the problem. And if we could get a whole group of people that are aware of that to bring that awareness to everyone, then we'd be on this playing field where everybody actually had the means to Google how to drywall or how to build a well and do those things. And we're so far from that. Like, there's such a disparity of opportunity on this planet that's the thing that we've fallen victim to, is just throwing money at the problem. When what we're doing is, instead of throwing humans at the problem, we're pretending that this meta concept of money is going to do fuck all. I mean,
the point that I'm trying to make is that the problem that we have isn't a problem of selflessness and selfishness as much as it is about understanding the problem that we have and understanding the proper way to go about these problems.
Yeah, I agree entirely, because I think people put on the mask of selflessness and the mask of charity through a selfish intention. And I don't even think it's that. I mean, I don't think that's far enough.
I'm just going to say it. That's the will to power. That's virtue signaling. They're just trying to make themselves look better.
But I don't think that that's the will to power. I think that that could be described as the will to power. And what I think is that there's actually three more layers to this cake. And inside of that is this sort of good intention that thinks that it needs to act out the will to power to be a good person. And when it gets there, it's this multi-headed hydra that is just disgusting. But I don't know. I'm certainly not going to say Nietzsche was wrong.
Well, he does bring up the irony of the free spirit, which is, is that, well, first of all, Nietzsche mentions that free spirits, the ones who are outsiders,
we philosophers,
we individuals thrive better through isolation, being alone with our own thoughts. And that's where we can generate our ideas. But the irony is, we need to put on masks in order to hide our true motive. And such spirits like that cannot let themselves be attached to anything that society gives us. Yeah. What this idea of you know, giving money to charity in order to fix these problems. Sure, that can be something that the individual can do, is to come up with an idea of raising money to build these resources to give to other people. But then there's also the idea of, you could just simply, with the knowledge that you've obtained on your own, you can go to somebody and teach them how to do it. remember the phrase in the Bible? Teach him, you know, if a man catches a fish, he can eat for a day. But if you teach a man a fish, he can
eat for the rest of his life, life, whatever. For I haven't gotten that far, but I know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've all heard it from our grandmothers.
Yeah. And the same is true in businesses. I believe that.
I had something to say, and then I lost it.
I feel like I did, too.
I guess what you had to say there, Pat, was so profound it blasted any notion of response out of my mind.
Yeah.
But I think I'll just kind of riff on the notion of teaching a man to fish or giving a man to fish. Because the problem is, we're assuming the man likes fish. And I remember what I was going to say. We're dealing with this problem of charity right now in Canada, and it's appalling and exploitive. What we're dealing with is this we charity thing, and we're just still finding out about the unethical crap that has been occurring with this. So our prime minister created, I think it was $90 million in funding for students to get paid while volunteering, and he wanted this charity called We Charity to deal with the administration of this. And it turns out half of his Liberal cabinet was employed, or their children were employed, and all of his family were employed and paid to speak for this charity over the past several years to the tune of like millions of dollars. And it's this crazy, disgusting, nepotistic, exploitive charity front for paying people that don't deserve to get $4,000 to speak for an hour. And I mean, he shouldn't even be in power, but we're not going to talk about my government or my leader right now. We're just going to talk about the notion that when you have a charity and when you have an organization, you, and when you have a bunch of people in that organization, selfishness tries to perpetuate the thing that they're comfortable with, and it stops looking at the solution and why they exist. And eventually you get this network of institutions that are now so closely knit that the notion of pulling one string to get to the heart of the problem is terrifying, and people would sooner just protest in the streets and try and chop leaders' heads off. And that doesn't resolve the problem either, because if everybody got involved in the charity that had the problem, potentially with some sort of armor that prevented them from burning out, the charity would do good. But the problem is the people that are most willing to and most easily able to get into those organizations are those that are descended from the people that birthed the organization. It's this crazy, awkward, weird thing where we've got people in power perpetuating their power. And power is beneficial, but abused power is completely useless, and it makes you want to burn the whole thing to the ground and rebuild it in your own vision. I think we've done enough burning of societies as a human race. I think that we've got a system right now, at least on this side of the world, that you can actually infiltrate and throw a coup, and people will just call that an election.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, but I feel like almost the Nietzschean perspective is you have to burn off the deadwood, as Jordan Peterson might say. It's like you gotta burn away some of the deadwood to make room for the new growth. But I wanted to make a point about what Nietzsche said about solitude, and I think he was just projecting his own limitations on that one. I mean, when he says to realize your full potential, you need to have solitude. Like, I don't know about you guys, but my most productive moments of realizing my potential are during these podcasts with you guys. So I don't know. I'm sure with most things, there has to be a balance there too. You definitely do need solitude. You definitely do need those moments to reflect. And like, I'm a consistent meditator, so I see the value there. But I think Nietzsche may have isolated himself a little bit too much, because we know how his story ended. That wasn't a pretty one.
Well, and I would almost argue that his solitude wasn't very solitary, and that he was trapped with himself, and that was very toxic, and that he was in this either of it. It was a vacuum or an echo chamber. But
right.
And I know from my own experience that is a terrible place to be in, because the brain does not differentiate between what you're thinking and what you're doing and what you're saying. And it thinks that you're having these conversations with societies when you're actually ruminating in your mind and your depression. And it's so easy to grow depression. Anybody can plant a seed of depression in their brain right now without even adding water. They will have a fully grown tree in a week. Just give them solitary confinement.
Yeah,
you need reflection. And I think that's more to the point, is you need reflection.
Yeah, definitely. And going back to what you said, Scott, didn't Friedrich Nietzsche have like a mental breakdown or something?
He sure did. I can describe how his mental breakdown went. He was just taking a stroll down the street and he saw this horse like really struggling in the streets, like its owner was whipping it or something. And then it just collapsed. And then he ran over to it and yelled, "I understand your pain," started crying maniacally, and embraced this dying horse. And that was basically the end of it for him. Didn't have another sane thought afterwards. I think afterwards he was like looked after by his anti-Semite sister and his sister's husband, which was another anti-Semitic writer. So that leads on
right,
to
and that ruined him.
That sounds like sounds like he was suffering from manic depression, I would say.
Yeah, I'd say, but like it definitely makes sense afterwards when you hear that story. It's like, oh, so that's why he was the favorite philosopher of the Nazis. It was because of his sister. His sister loved the Nazis. She loved Hitler. She had a bust of Nietzsche himself made for Hitler. There's a famous photograph of Hitler with the bust of Nietzsche. It's pretty crazy. What do you think of the will to power in general, guys? Like, he spends the first little bit tearing apart the will to truth, the will to live. You know, nowadays we have the will to reproduce or spread our genes if you listen to Dawkins, or the will to well-being if you listen to Sam Harris. So where do you think he lands on the spectrum with all the wills that drive us? Do you think they all exist? Do you think it's just one?
I think it is seen in the final part of the book, which is, what is noble, and how can one live their full potential? And I think that in regards to power, one must learn to speak properly and gain full advantage of the genius as much as possible, and then use it to their own advantage. And that also, he also criticized his own language. Like, he criticized his own country for essentially saying that there is a lack of assertion in the language, and that there's no sense of creativity at all. And I think that when he talks about language, he's essentially using language as a way to capture rigid and fixed ideas. One that is able to be free, like what we discussed on individuals living in solitude with their own ideas. I think that might be the answer. Well, I don't want to say that might be the answer. That's just my interpretation of what he means.
Yeah, it's hard to say, like, this is what Nietzsche meant. It's all of my notes, all 24 pages worth, are just, this is what came to my mind as I was reading these words. As for what he actually meant, I'm still about 50-50.
I think any attempt to define all human existence into one solitary will to X is silly. I give it 2 thumbs down for will to power. I'd give it 3 if I had 3, but I don't. I think that we're doing the same thing with human existence as we did with God, and it's going to kill us, which is that you think that you can describe a human as a square and put a square into a square hole, when what we're doing is we're looking at, like, hindsight reactions and saying, oh, that's what this is, because look at all of the evidence that this props up what I'm saying. And it's just like, no. Like, there's all sorts of things. You could call them wills, you can call them gods, you can call them impulses, you can call them what you will. But as soon as you start getting into this sort of area where you're saying, this is how all humans work, that's just so ignorant. Like, no, it's not. Like, yeah. I can give you tons of evidence to say you're wrong, and I don't have the right answer. And I'm much more comfortable with that. And it doesn't help many people who want the answer, but might I suggest meditating for an hour?
Yeah, for me, it comes down to how you define power. But, like, this chapter for me seems like it's structured that he's taking all these other philosophers and saying, you believe in the will to truth? Well, it's not actually the will to truth, because the only reason you would be truthful is to gain power in some respect. And there's many different ways to gain power. And there's different personality types that gain power and climb the hierarchy in different ways and different methods. But ultimately, it all comes down to power. Even if you're just looking after your well-being or just to spread your genes, that itself is a form of power.
I think probably, too, our connotation of power hinders my acceptance of the notion of will to power, because power for me just sort of leads to corruption. When, like, I liked what he said, that all living organisms seek to expend their energy. And for me, that was enough. Because I think as humans, you know, and it's why we treat children nicely, you know, like, if you see a baby, you're more likely to give it the best of you. Not because humans deserve the best of you, but because the impression of the best of you will develop that thing into something that will hopefully, you know, latch on to the best of everyone and the best of everything and become better than what we are. And the will to power is simply an exercise of expending energy, just as much as the will to truth is, and just as much as the will to selflessness is, and the will to selfishness is. And I don't think it's fair to say that there is one mode that humans have existed on for millennia. I think that there may be one mode that humans could exist on for millennia to come that may be very utilitarian, but it's still not the right answer. I don't think there is a right answer. Maybe there is. I'll let you know when I die. But in the interim, I think the point is the question.
Yeah. There's another quote at the start that I wanted to bring up. It says, our body is but a social structure composed of many souls. So in that respect, it made me think of two things. Paganism makes more sense than monotheism, or polytheism makes more sense than monotheism. And that the will to power can't be the only one thing, because if we're all made up of different souls in this consciousness congress, then, you know, they're all going to want different things. So the will to power is going to be activated at one point, where the will to truth is activated at another point, or some other wills that we have yet to define.
100%. I like all of the multi-godded religions more and more as we read these things, because it's not about having an answer of what God is or who God is or how many there are. It's just simply pick your favorite and express it. If you're the god of the sea, you're the god of the sea. But for Christ's sake, choose one and be happy about it. And if you don't like it in 5 years, choose another one, because there's so much going on in us that
I just really like the notion that there's more than one ideal to shoot for. Like,
yeah,
we only have one in, you know, our tradition, let's say, like our monotheistic religion that's taken over the West. It's be like Jesus. And if you're not being like Jesus, you're missing the mark. You know, back in the day, you could be like Apollo. If you're not like Apollo, well, be like Aries. If you're not like Aries, well, you know, you can pick one of the other ones. Well, if you're a girl, you got your whole extra pantheon too. You got Aphrodite and Minerva, you know, just keep going.
Yeah.
Nietzsche picked Dionysus. That's a fine choice.
Exactly. Like, the limits we put on Christianity have been put on to the faithful, right? Like, as soon as you bring it that close to earth and human-like in quality, literally with Jesus, right? Like, it ruins it for the rest of us, because I don't want to be a carpenter. I want to be a shoemaker.
Yeah, and it makes more sense when we look at integrating our ancestry too, because, you know, when all of the other, like, pagan societies intermingled with each other, it was, okay, our gods are meeting each other and treating with each other, and they're making a deal, so, like, two of them can come together and create a link in the tribes. Like, same with, like, some of the old Canaanite tribes did the same kind of stuff. But when you come into Judaism or something like that, it's like, no, we're only allowed our one God. If you see any other ideal for humanity, you're not worth our time. You're only worth our war.
Yeah. Would you guys recommend this book? Sorry, Synapsian, you lose.
That's honestly a hard question. Would I recommend Beyond Good and Evil?
Not to everybody.
Well, Nietzsche himself didn't want anybody, or didn't want everybody to read it. He's just like, he says multiple times, this book is only for those who are able to comprehend it. Us philosophers, we noble ones, we scholars, are the only ones really ready to take on the information. But I don't know. I definitely felt like I wasn't ready to crack into this book before I jumped into it. But I don't know if I ever would be, really. Like, you just kind of have to take that leap. It's one of those books that if you're ready for it, you're ready for it. If you're not, you're not.
Yeah. You have to take it with a grain of salt, essentially.
Yeah, that too, for sure. You can't just pick up this book and say this is gospel, but I wouldn't say that about the gospel or any book.
No. And, like, so in high school, there's a philosophy class. Should Beyond Good and Evil be, like, on the curriculum? Or is it a university-level thing?
Well, I wouldn't know, because I wasn't allowed to take philosophy in high school because my grades were too low. But that's just me being bitter.
I think it's, like, master's-level university.
Master's level? Jeez, like, post-bachelor.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I hear my own objections to Plato coming up in my head too, where, like, is that a form of censorship where you're saying, oh no, you're not ready for it, you shouldn't read it just yet? I think if you want to read it, you should, and that's for sure. But, like, it's wherever your path takes you.
Yep.
Like, if you're 18 years old and you want to read Beyond Good and Evil, go crazy. But, like, at the same time, don't go crazy. don't get too attached to these ideas. I think like being over the age of 25 was a good time for me to read Beyond Good and Evil. And I think
Right.
even at a master's level, you're at the earliest you could be doing your master's at the age of 22, and like that's still almost too young. And when you think about the Republic and the notion of forcing education on people, like this is not one of the books that I want jammed down your throat at a young age.
Yeah, but then you think of, Nietzsche was only 24 years old when he was a professor of philology. So,
Yeah.
if you're that smart, you're doing yourself a disservice by putting Beyond Good and Evil on your read later list. But
Yeah.
like when my friends come up to me and they're like, "Hey man, give me a book recommendation." And I say, like, "What was the last thing you read?" Well, Harry Potter was about the last thing I read. I read a couple of Game of Thrones books, some other high fantasy. I'm don't read Nietzsche. Read Hemingway. Read some old fiction first. Maybe some nonfiction. Maybe some science fiction. There's
Maybe some Orwellian.
definitely a progression. And the one quote that I love to bring up over and over again is, "Read what you love until you love to read."
Well, that's about as far as I think I can take Nietzsche. I know that I have been grasping at straws this entire time, and I'm proud of it.
Yeah,
Same here.
I feel like I could go for a bit longer, but it'd just be like me going through my notes and being like, "Well, what do you think about this line? And then what do you think about this line?" Turn
Yeah.
into a Jordan Peterson interview all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a good place to wrap up.
Yeah, we've been going for a while, so before we start to ramble too much. Yeah. So check out our website, like, comment, subscribe. Anchor, YouTube, everywhere you get your podcasts.
Bookwave.club if you didn't catch it in the first 5 minutes.
And if you have, what your thoughts are on Beyond
Right.
Good and Evil, you can leave a comment. If there's anything we've missed, let us know.
And as Synapsian said, rawr,
Ask us some questions.
I swear we will find an office for Synapsian in the future, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always somewhere else. You guys can fund us, we'll fund an office.
Yeah, he's just rolling around in a sleeping bag outside right now, so.
Don't feel
He's a
bad for me, Emma.
vagabond.
Anyways.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
Till next time, folks.